So I realized this talk, which I'm calling The Tension Between Formal Practice and Everyday Life, grows a little bit out of the last talk I gave, which was, Is Buddhism Compatible with Modern Life in the 21st Century? Where I talked some about like monastic practice versus busy lay practice. And maybe because of that talk, people have been thinking. And so I've met with quite a number of folks over the last couple weeks for whom this topic is very alive right now. So I'm going to say the Dharma practice is behavior of body, speech, or mind that helps us awaken to reality and puts us in harmony with it. So any behavior of body, speech, or mind that helps us awaken to reality with a capital R and puts us in harmony with it. And reality, being, I feel this is the radical thing about Buddhism, is that it says all of the suffering you might experience can be relieved if you really see reality as it is. Now, we encourage moral behavior and all of that, of course, but it's not a matter of if you act in a certain way and purify yourself, then you can attain either heaven or, you can attain some state which will be liberated. This is just like just see things clearly. And if you see reality clearly, you're not anxious and depressed. You're full of gratitude and unconditional ease. Like, I don't know, before I really had a personal conviction about that, I would look at the world and think, I don't know about this place. There's a lot of good stuff, but there's so much evil. I don't know really how it turns out in the end, where the balance is. I don't know. But then the Dharma says, if you really see everything as it is, without the filter of our preconceived notions and expectations, that what we achieve is a spiritual liberation, ease, gratitude. We see inherent perfection in everything. So the Dharma practice then is our effort to see this truth and also to live in harmony with it. So sometimes we're living in harmony with it because that helps us see as well. But we're also living in harmony with it because, well, we want to live in harmony with it, right? We want to live in harmony with the way things really are. So it's kind of like 2 feet in walking, the realization and the embodiment. And when we realize, when we awaken to it, we see it for ourselves, it helps us embody it. And when we embody it, it helps us awaken. So that's Dharma practice. Formal Dharma practice has recognizable form. That's where the formal comes from. It doesn't necessarily mean rigid and serious, although it often is. It has form. And most forms are handed down to us from our tradition, practicing with Sangha, chanting, Dharma study, Zazen, ritual, ceremony, retreat, formal vows, maintaining an altar. Basically, if it has some form, then it's what I'm calling formal Dharma practice. And some of these forms are handed down through our tradition, and I'm going to do them pretty similarly to you. We do them together. It's a recognizable thing. But we can also create our own forms of practice, of formal practice. And generally, these are kind of repeated things designed to encourage mindfulness, maybe gardening or cooking or cleaning in mindful silence, picking up our tea or coffee cup with both hands. So it may not be a form we keep in common with Sangha, but they would probably recognize we were doing some form of Dharma practice. So I was like, I brainstormed a list of the features of formal practice, even if it's not one of these traditional forms. So generally, it's silent, no talking or listening to entertainment. I think you could probably like play music, like an instrument or something, as formal practice, but you would be approaching it differently. So it's not necessarily that's just an absence of sound, but it's not just there to kind of entertain or distract. It's not social. We may be near others, but we are not interacting with them. As we do it, we are letting go of extra thinking. We're just doing what we are doing. We're not hurrying or multitasking. We're conscientiously and deliberately dedicating time and space for this behavior, kind of like Zazen. So I'm going to mindfully garden for an hour, or I am going to take a mindful walk, or I am going to, there's a deliberate space and time dedicated to it. And it is aimed, like Zazen, at becoming intimate with life. If necessary, building tolerance for life, making peace with life, and hopefully seeing the true nature of life and being one with life. So those are my five like efforts in Zazen. And so we can do these formal Dharma practices are aimed at the same thing. So formal practice supports and nourishes us in a monastic community or during sesshin. So that's our silent residential retreats. We follow a schedule of formal practice 24 hours a day. Even work and rest is done in silence at particular times, along with the rest of the community. And the whole thing is aimed at these deeper purposes. And it's very conducive to settling into stillness and seeing through our delusions. There's very few choices to make. We're just moving together and in silence. So for many, if not most of us, as much as we may enjoy and appreciate the rest of our lives, as difficult as it may be to find time for formal practice, to fit it in, whether that's a retreat or Zazen within our day, we find time in formal practice immensely rewarding. Especially once we develop a sense of path, a sense of spiritual path, it can begin to feel like formal practice is where we're doing the real work, making the real progress, or even the place where life feels more real. I mean, I love my life and I love activities and all that, but when I slow down in retreat, there's sometimes like, wow. This is more real than all of that stuff that I'm usually doing. Like, oh my God, why don't we live like this all the time? That's how it feels. So, what I'm calling everyday life Dharma practice is spontaneous, responsive practice aimed at awakening and manifesting compassion right here, right now. Whatever is arising. It doesn't take any particular form. There's no space or time, which is like I'm doing that. It's permeable, it's open, it's responsive. What choices can you make in this moment to relieve suffering for self or other, to see more clearly, to manifest the truth more completely? So in lay life, we engage, and I count myself as being in lay life, And we engage in everyday life practice almost all our waking hours, and only are occasionally able to dip into formal practice. Maybe we just dip in for 20 minutes a day, or oops, maybe even an hour a day. Maybe it's just a couple times a week that we have that kind of deliberately dedicated formal practice time. Often our attempts to introduce more formal practice into our lives can seem doomed to produce little more than frustration, as the constantly shifting demands of lay life and the people in our lives require our practice to be spontaneous and responsive. Intentions to, I'm going to do this and dedicate some Dharma study, or I'm going to sit, like, it depends on the life you have, right? If your life is a little simpler, you might be able to do that. If you live by yourself, if you're retired, perhaps. But the busier your life is, the more competing demands you have. Or we may find that we lack the self-discipline to impose much form on our lives on our own. And this is the case for almost all of us. Don't feel bad if that's the case. There's a reason we do formal practice together. Even if you're retired, you have many things to do and take care of, many things you want to do. And it can feel awkward to artificially construct and dedicate time and space to formal practice on your own, at least in a way that's as clear and focused as it is with others. Silent, not social, letting go of extra thinking, not hurrying or multitasking, consciously and deliberately dedicating time and space for this activity, and aimed like Zazen at becoming intimate with life. It's just kind of easier, right? If you're going to go on a hot hike on a nice day like this, that's just thinking about stuff, or looking at the pretty birds, or listening to your novel, or who knows, right? Like it's easier to just kind of go with the flow and enjoy yourself, as opposed to, okay, now I'm going to walk without distraction. So may not be the case with you, but many Zen practitioners, myself included, struggle balancing formal practice and everyday life activities. Maybe there's that sense of that lack of self-discipline, which I think more accurately, I think self-discipline is kind of a Western concept that is empty of any inherent meaning. I don't think there really is such a thing. What we are is a bundle of competing desires. And part of us wants to, have a good, strong meditation practice and do such and such an exercise regularly and floss our teeth and all that. Part of us knows that and wants that. And part of us is just like, I'm too tired. So what I think about it is, when we're talking about self-discipline, we're talking about being able to tune in with the parts of ourselves which have longer-term aspirations. Can we connect with that sense of ourself that says, this isn't the healthiest way to eat? I don't think I'll just go ahead and have this meal, right? Well, I think I'm gonna plan my day so I can do this thing that I know I will be happy I will have done, as opposed to kind of going this moment by moment how we feel like doing things, which is usually more shorter term thinking. So it may be tricky for navigating those competing desires, or we may have a shortage of time, energy, or resources. This is a big one for many folks, especially if you have a family, lots of friends, dependent parents, who knows? It's like, where are you even going to find the time to do these things? Competing demands and responsibilities, the needs of other beings in our life. If you do live with others, it can feel like, and to some extent, it literally is. When you create space for formal practice, you are creating a space they're not in, right? You are creating a space like because you're not socializing, right? They're not, unless they're joining you in the practice, which is unlikely. It's saying, you're not welcome in this little formal practice space that I've can created. And it can be awkward. I mean, I think each of us has to navigate how much of that we do, how much of it we insist. Now I'm going to go away on retreat. Now I'm going to the Zen Center, whatever. We're taking, and I feel like we're taking time and attention and energy that we might be giving to the people in our life and doing formal practice instead. And yet, if that's all we do is, please others and give up and don't take any of this space, then we're not really being authentic and we're not really taking care of ourselves and being, showing up wholeheartedly in that relationship. So it's a tightrope walk sometimes. So people often feel when this is difficult, balancing formal practice and everyday life, can feel guilty or self-critical if they don't have that self-discipline, or frustrated and resentful, especially if we came to practice after our commitments were made. And all of a sudden we have all of these demands, and we want to be doing more formal practice, but then we can't. Or it feels like we can't. Or we feel like the effort to practice just adds more stress to our lives, just becomes another thing that we need to do when we need to fit in and we need to check off our list, which is like, sometimes that's more than you want. Or people can feel desperate. Like we're unable to devote enough time to formal practice and therefore will be unable to progress on the path. Or if you're a Dharma nut like me, even that time spent outside of formal practice, I mean, I don't feel like this anymore, but once upon a time, I definitely did. Time spent outside of formal practice feels like being carried down a fast flowing stream of karma. And in terms of becoming intimate with life, is a waste of time. So, any of you out there think you're a little crazy for thinking that? I mean, I don't know, maybe we are crazy, but I certainly felt that at a time. So, ironically, it can seem like practice in some ways can make us more miserable. But it's not practice that's making us miserable. Practice relieves suffering. When practice seems to be making us miserable, it's our own thoughts about practice that are making us miserable, that are causing us dukkha. So ultimately, formal practice in all its forms is just a method, it's just a means to an end. Only this moment is real. Everyday life Dharma practice is spontaneous, responsive practice aimed at awakening and manifesting compassion right here, right now, whatever is arising. What choices can you make in this moment to relieve suffering for self or other? See more clearly, manifest the truth more completely. This is what is happening in each moment within the context of formal practice. The only difference is that there's fewer decisions, less stimulus, less activity. It's a simplified setting, mentally and emotionally more restful. So I had this image when I got to this point and I was writing this talk of Tai Chi, like slow Tai Chi, where you're really mindfully moving. You can pay attention to your posture and your stance versus Aikido, where at a certain point in your training, I forget what it's called. If Junko was here, she could tell me, where you stand and then people run at you one after another. And like the more advanced in your training, the more people there are. And they run at you and you are like meet each one of them and like, you know, throw them to the side. They, you know, using their own energy against them. But that takes this like, you know, this is in a way, it's the same thing, right? It's like body awareness. It takes the same, it's the same discipline. It's just one is we're going very slowly and learning and paying attention. And then the other one is inactivity, right? Just so formal practice, everyday life practice, it's not an either or. In both settings, the practice is the same. It's only the conditions that differ. And to just point momentarily toward the deeper aspect of practice, during the continuous practice retreat, I'm going to be teaching from Dogen's fascicle, Gyoji, which is often translated, the translation I'm going to be using actually says ceaseless practice. Strangely, Nishijima and Cross use pure conduct and observance of precepts instead of ceaseless practice. So this is, I don't know, there's different ways to interpret these characters, I guess. So pure conduct and observance of the precepts is also AKA continuous practice or ceaseless practice. In the great truth of the Buddhist ancestors, there is always pure conduct and observance of precepts. I'm just going to say ceaseless practice, above which there is nothing. It continues in an unbroken cycle so that there is not the slightest interval between establishment of the mind, training, Bodhi and Nirvana. Ceaseless practice is a continuing cycle. For this reason, it is not doing that is forced from ourselves, and it is not doing that is forced from outside. It is ceaseless practice that has never been tainted. The virtue of this ceaseless practice maintains ourselves and maintains the outside world. The import is that in the moment of my conduct and observance, the whole earth and the whole sky through the 10 directions are totally covered by the virtue. Others do not know it, and I do not know it, but it is so. Conduct and observance, ceaseless practice, is not loved by worldly people, but it may be the real refuge of all human beings. Sometimes this virtue is not apparent. Sometimes the virtue of this ceaseless practice is evident, so the will arises and we practice it. Sometimes this virtue is not apparent, so we neither see nor hear nor sense it. Although it is not apparent, we should learn and experience that it is not concealed, for it is not tainted by concealment and revelation or by continuance and disappearance. So when we really explore the nature of self, we realize that it's not ourselves and our practice are not what they seem, right? When we think, all right, now I'm practicing, now I'm consciously practicing. And then that other moment I wasn't, like, it's not that simple. There's no real I that's behind this deliberate effort to practice, or not what we think, right? It's something deeper moving through us that permeates both our formal practice, our deliberate everyday practice, and all the times in between. Still, it doesn't mean there's no difference between formal practice and everyday life practice to us in a practical way. So on one extreme, you might say, you don't need formal practice. The real practice is every moment, how you meet every moment. So it doesn't really matter what your practice looks like or whether you do any formal practice. If you do that, it's very unlikely your practice will last, let alone deepen. I mean, you'll still live and grow wiser and all of that, I'm sure. But practice in the sense that we talk about it together doesn't tend to last without some kind of support and form. The other extreme is formal practice is where the real work happens. And the more of it you can fit into your life, the faster your progress will be. So thinking like this is a recipe for discontent or even conflict in your life. Unless you just leave home and leave everything behind and go to a monastery. But I can tell you even then, it's not enough. It's not like you, I don't know. I think there's a monastery, there's a Christian monastery in France where like some of the monks are completely cloistered. They live in a little cell, they study and pray all day, and there's other brothers in the monastery who aren't quite as cloistered, and they do the cooking and all that, and just bring food to these totally cloistered monks. First of all, I don't know that I could hack that. But it's like even then, there are things that you have to deal with and do. So it's possible to be dissatisfied with this balance between formal practice and informal practice. And I went to Tassajara and I had a wonderful time during the practice period, the 3 months of intensive practice period. And then in order to like pay your way, for being there during that, then there's a guest season, which is 5 months long in the summertime. And then as a student, you are on staff, right? And I cleaned guest cabins for that 5 months. And, you know, there's some sitting, but most of the time, you know, and the students can go use the mineral springs and I don't know, it was, and the food's really good. I was like, this is a waste of time. I should be in a Japanese monastery. This is like, this was what I had to do in order to have those cloistered months. So how much formal practice do we need? I feel like this is asking, how much rest do you need? Or how much practice do you need of a particular skill or something before a performance or a test? And it's not like there's any hard and fast rule, right? You're going to have to kind of judge for yourself. It might be different for one person than another. But I think it's important to recognize how formal practice supports and feeds us. Formal practice isn't as if emotionally or mentally draining. Usually. I mean, it has its own challenges, especially in retreat. But for the most part, it might be challenging in different ways, but kind of the exhaustion, decision fatigue, stress, all those things that we usually encounter in life are, you know, much decreased. We put everything down, right? And we're talking about whether this is, you know, Zazen or time with Sangha or retreat, this space that we make for formal practice. Even if we're doing it on our own, we're just going to do mindful gardening, right? And we're like, for this period of time, I'm not going to worry about all that shit. I'm just going to let myself just do this simple activity. Things are slower and simpler. We notice the change, and this is valuable. It usually reminds us constantly of our aspirations. This is the whole reason we're doing this. Okay, even in the context of session retreat, right? It's like, you might look around and get a little, if you have a practice job or something, you might get a little wrapped up. And then it's like, the only reason we're doing any of this is just to become intimate with life and awaken, right? So like, in a way, none of this matters. The whole purpose of it is just to aim us toward this. And we have the support of the tradition and other like-minded people in formal practice. So it's possible to get attached to formal practice, start feeling aversion to everyday life, or long for formal practice as a way to get away from the challenges of our life. So here's some merits of everyday life practice. So moment by moment, it is exactly the same as formal practice. It keeps us on our toes, challenging, demanding, doesn't let us get complacent. We have to be responsive to and generous toward others, preventing navel gazing. Can get us out of ourselves. It demands we actualize simultaneously with realization, no delay. It constantly challenges our dualistic thinking and attachments as it constantly changes and is infinitely complex. It keeps us honest with ourselves and humble. You know, sometimes I have had some kind of insight or touched something, some experience during session, and just part of me just feels this trepidation. Now I'm going to go back into everyday life and see it all kind of fall apart, right? Like, you kind of sustain it for a few days, maybe, but then pretty soon, like, the stress builds up again, and you're just like, everyday life practice really shows us, you know, how much have we integrated whatever it is that we have awakened to. So, just as an argument for active practice, so I really recommend, if you haven't done so already, assuming that you practice as a layperson and you have, you know, you experience this tension between formal practice and active practice, this everyday life practice. One of the greatest teachings that we have is Dogen's instructions for the Zen cook or the Tenzo. So there are many different translations of this out there. But Dogen describes the Tenzo's role in great detail. Practical, he goes, you know, really practical, and then typical of Dogen, he goes like, and therefore, you know, and he does, it's transcended and far up. But in Zen, in our Soto Zen tradition, the role of the Tenzo is greatly revered. Well, ideally, only a senior mature practitioner fills the role of Tenzo. And it is viewed as a profound place of practice and a place to manifest practice. I shall now take up the work of the Tenzo, covering a period of one complete day. After the noon meal, the Tenzo should go to the Tsusu and Kansu to get the rice, vegetables, and other ingredients for the following morning and noon meals. Once he has these, he must handle them as carefully as if they were his own eyes. Renyong of Baoyang said, "Use the property and possessions of the community as carefully as if they were your own eyes." The Tenzo should handle all food he receives with respect, as if it were to be used in a meal for the emperor. Cooked and uncooked food must be handled in the same manner. Next, all the officers meet in the kitchen or pantry and decide what food is to be prepared for the following day. For example, the type of rice gruel, the vegetables, the seasoning. In the Qinyang Qingui, it says, "When deciding on the amount of food and number of side dishes for the morning and noonday meals, the Tenzo should consult with the other officers. When they have chosen the meals, the menus should be posted on the notice boards in front of the abbot's room as well as in front of the study hall. When this has been done, preparations for the next morning's meal may begin. You must not leave the washing of rice or preparation of vegetables to others, but must carry out this work with your own hands. Put your whole attention into the work, seeing just what the situation calls for. Do not be absent-minded in your activities, nor so absorbed in one aspect of a matter that you fail to see its other aspects. Do not overlook one drop in the ocean of virtue. By entrusting the work to others, cultivate a spirit which strives to increase the source of goodness upon the mountain of goodness. Again, in the Chanyuan Chinghui, we find, if the Tenzo offers a meal without a harmony of the six flavors and the three qualities, it cannot be said that he serves the community. So the six flavors are bitter, sour, sweet, salty, mild, and hot. The three virtues are light and flexible, clean and neat, conscientious and thorough. So the third of these, the conscientious and thorough, is the Japanese word nyoho. It generally has three meanings. First, everything that exists, all things and phenomena. The second, the natural laws that apply to all phenomena. And third, the Buddha Dharma, that is the composed or settled activity that works toward greater composure and stability. Here, the expression includes all three meanings, that is, all things functioning as they naturally do in accord with the natural laws and settling toward greater stability is nyoho. So I love the fact that, you know, this idea that you might go to a monastery and then just be meditating all the time has been an illusion since the beginning of monasteries, because somebody's got to do the work, right? So a lot of times they would have it, have it divvied up. You might like spend a term kind of as a Zendo monk, then you spend a term as a kind of staff monk. And if we're longing for this formal practice and stillness, we might be disappointed when we come to the Zendo, we come to retreat, and then we're assigned a practice role. That means that we have to do stuff, we have to prepare stuff, we have to be out of the Zendo sometimes and whatever. And you might be especially disappointed if you get the job of a cook and now you're going to have to do all kinds of prep ahead of time and shopping and preparing. And then you're sitting there on the cushion and you're like, okay, for lunch, I got to think, okay, I washed 8 potatoes, but I should probably use 10. Like, you got all this stuff going on. I mean, I've cooked 3 meals a day. I mean, as not all by myself, but as Tenzo, 3 meals a day for 7 days for 70 people. That's a lot. So I have never been as busy as that. Never. It doesn't even compare with my everyday life. I mean, this is like, get there extra early in the morning, prepare stuff for the breakfast. You know, it's dawn till dusk, just, and I just loved it. I mean, it's like, especially in that context, because I don't, this is because it's still formal practice, right? It's still, in some ways, even though I'm busier, it's simpler than everyday life because it's not competing demands. It's one demand, one thing. Your one purpose is to feed people. And as Dogen points out, feed people good food. You don't do a half-assed job just like, well, I want to just open a number 10 can of peas and carrots and dump that in a bowl and heat it up for people because I want to get to the Zendo. You make it beautiful, you make it delicious, you vary flavors and tastes, all of this stuff. So I feel like giving myself over to that activity just burned up all the bullshit. When I did get to the meditation cushion, my mind was more still in a way than ever. Yeah, I mean, every once in a while, a little thought comes up about the food, but if I'm not bothered about that, it's just like I got no time. I got no time or energy for like, I don't know how my practice is doing. I don't know, maybe I should make changes in my life. Like, I'm not thinking about that. I'm just the tenzo. So that isn't within formal practice, so it can be more challenging to do that in the course of whatever it is that we do each day. But just because it's more challenging doesn't mean that isn't the practice. That is the practice, to just give ourselves completely to whatever it is that we're doing in each moment. So my recommendation is to fit as much formal practice in your life as you can, while balancing it with the needs of the people and beings in your life, other responsibilities. And be aware when you are prioritizing unnecessary activities or commitments over formal practice. Not because there's a certain amount of formal practice you should be doing. You should feel guilty if you go do something else. Just because of what's deep in your own heart. How do you want to have lived? Do you want to die without having clarified the great mystery before you awaken to your true self nature? Each of us has to just navigate this and answer the question for ourselves. But I know I can speak for myself that it is easy to get pulled into various kinds of karmic engagements, which then mean less time and space for the formal practice, which really supports and keeps a strong basis, strong thread going in my practice. And the moment you start to feel the dualistic tension between formal practice and everyday life, remind yourself that in each moment there is no difference at all. All right, open it up for our comments and questions. Jinryu.
Thank you very much. I did have to chuckle when you were talking about the Tenzo activity, and then when you get back to your seat. And the first thought in my mind was, when you get back to your seat, you twitch. Because that is what I did. After being on my feet for so long, I just sat down and could not stop moving, because my
You froze. Maybe you turn your video off. Uh-oh. It's that kind of freezing. All right. She will probably drop off in a moment and then come back. Anyone else? James.
I was really kind of having a personal reaction to your statement about, the work of the Tenzo feeling like a burden, but it actually being such a great place to practice. Because, and I'll tell on myself, but at that last session in April, when you put me in that role of doing some of the most of the meal prep, my initial reaction was I bristle a little bit, and like, what? Like, this isn't what I do, And I probably that experience of being put in that role, having to come to terms with being put in that role, then actually throwing myself into the role wholeheartedly and performing the role over the course of the session is probably one of the most important lessons I've ever learned in my entire Buddhist. It was profoundly, sorry, it was profoundly moving. It was absolutely profoundly moving, and I learned so much about my ability to see acts like chopping carrots, as the practice in a way that I never did before. It was just such an amazingly life-changing experience. And I really thank you for giving me that opportunity and helping me to see something that I couldn't see for myself. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Thank you.
Thank you for that testimonial. It just warms my heart. And I feel like another aspect of the Tenzo rule, which I really aspired to, and again, I think all of this is applicable, right? It's all applicable to our everyday life and activities. And that was not just how the Tenzo treats the food, but how does the Tenzo work with the other people in the kitchen, right? So I did not want people to come in and feel like I'm stressed and running around and they should kind of stay out of my way, right? Or I wanted somehow to communicate like the joy of what we were doing together so that people would have some of that experience just when they were just coming, not if they were in a cook role, but they were just coming to chop the carrots during the work period. Could you communicate some of that joy to them? And so one of my greatest rewards was at a closing circle after one retreat when I was Tenzo, several people mentioned that one of their favorite things was working in the kitchen. So I was like, Jinryu, do you want to continue? You left us where you were saying you had to squirm a lot.
Well, just to add to that, I can't say more than what James did. I only heard the tail end of what he said. But it is an incredibly rewarding opportunity to serve in that way. Even if you are among the ones that are in the kitchen, you don't have to necessarily be the Tenzo to do that. Another quick question about the essay that you're going to be, the fascicle you're going to be talking to us about. Is that Gyoji? Do I have it right? And there's a part one and two. Are you doing the whole schmear?
I am only doing the intro section and maybe Shakyamuni, because it's Dogen's longest fascicle, and essentially just I don't know. I mean, it's all lovely, but he's this lovely intro section, and then he talks about Shakyamuni, and then he talks about like I don't know, like 20 other ancestors. So every ancestor has its own chapter. So we'll just do that first part.
Thank you.
And I will be kind of last minute, but I've had a lot going on. I'm going to be like choosing the excerpt and it'll be available on the website. But many people have some kind of translation of Dogen, so it is just the very first part of the first chapter of Gyochi. Jessica.
Well, I just want to say that was a very, very inspiring talk. I really needed that. Thank you. And all of its aspects. And have a lot of cooking to do over the next couple of days to get ready for the continuous practice retreat. And so I'm Tenzo for one, but I've been kind of feeling, oh, I want to do all this cooking and get ready, and this isn't the best time. And so, I just had a major attitude readjustment. So thank you.
John.
Thank you for the talk. I guess you talked about Buddhism, how we can relieve our suffering if we see reality as it is. We're full of gratitude and unconditional ease. My problem is the suffering of others, and it doesn't seem like any amount of formal practice or daily practice can relieve the part of suffering in me that is the suffering of others. And I can't seem to help others. It's like I just got to tell them to find Zen and maybe they can relieve their own suffering. So, how is it that we relieve that part of suffering in us that is the suffering of others?
Well, I mean, I know you know this, but this is what's coming to mind. There's a difference between pain and suffering in a Buddhist sense. I mean, different people use different words, but I feel like Buddhism never says life's going to be free of pain. Matter of fact, it says you can't escape the pain. But that's different from dukkha, like that extra suffering we add. So I think like you're saying, I mean, there's no way to fix all of it, and we have to watch beings suffer, and that feels terrible. And that's like part of life, but how can we do that without adding something extra to it? James Ford, who wrote the book we're studying on Tuesday, has another book that says, if you're lucky, your heart will break. Can we be that open? But in my experience anyway, when I am open and I'm not adding something extra or attached to an agenda to fix it or anything like that, there's something clean about it. It's like it moves through me and doesn't get stuck. Whereas when I'm trying to make sense of it or rationalize it or deny it, or I want it to end or something, that it gets stuck right here and it And it, then it's like an anguish.
So I guess I feel in everyday practice like I can ease the suffering of others somewhat more than formal practice, where formal practice seems to pull me away from everybody else. So it's and the more formal practice I do, the less interaction I am doing with other people. So how do I get over that quandary of taking myself out of the world for formal practice when I'm not helping others?
I mean, it is like I go out to Great Bao Zen Monastery regularly, and there's often a lot of young people out there who are kind of giving it a try and exploring how do they want to spend their life, right? And they're often drawn to doing some more of this monastic practice, and yet their heart bleeds for the suffering in the world, and they feel called to go do something about it. And so it feels, so many of them feel like they can't or they don't want to just do this thing. I don't know. I mean, I guess we have to look at the results of our own formal practice and judge whether it's actually making us more effective in the world. For me, that's like it always had to translate like that. That's kind of there's an aspect of delusion needing it to measure up that way. But I did. I needed to know that this practice was actually making me more effective in the world. And I'm really convinced that it does, if only because, I don't know, there's all these different ways that we can help people. And it's rarely like fix their problems, right? But I feel like one of the greatest gifts that we give as practitioners to others is a sense of grounded calm. And that is immense. sometimes is just no matter what is going on. I mean, you may not feel exactly like, oh, I'm so full of equanimity, but really, relative to a lot of people, you know, we are. We don't shy away from suffering or stress. We don't shy away from death. We can just be there. And I don't know, I think about that in terms of you know, how often should I go away to session when I think we're in the middle of a climate emergency? And yet, when I think about the future and the kinds of things we might be facing, I feel like I should be as grounded as I possibly can get, right? I should be able to take the largest possible perspective. If I can maintain equanimity in the midst of that, that will be an immense gift to people. Right. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahatattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Damiel. Could I ask
Thanks,
Betty
everyone.
not to shut us off for a minute? I want to try something with Bob real quick.